Oh, hey there, listeners and juicers. Before we get into today's episode, I wanted to let you know that if you have fallen in love with the Draw Your Dice podcast and want to help put some new fruit on the table, but don't feel comfortable making a monthly commitment, well, you can support the show via the Acast supporter feature. No gift too large, nor too small. Just click on the link in the show description and know that I am sending you the strongest hug when you do so.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I think there's lots of meaningful discussions about how we price our work, and because we don't want to depreciate the whole value of the category by making things cheap, but we want to make it as accessible and inclusive as possible, especially to folks who are marginalized, don't have a lot of money to spend on things like this.
My name is Jeremy Gage, and welcome to the Draw Your Dice podcast. This is an educational show involving all things tabletop role-playing industry. Listen alongside me as we hear from creators, entrepreneurs, and supporters about their personal best practices, principles, and philosophies. I encourage anyone from the budding game designer to a seasoned publisher and everyone in between to sit down with us and enjoy today's episode. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Draw Your Dice podcast. My name is Jeremy Gage, as you heard in the intro, but as always, the show is never about me. It's about who I brought, and I have brought a doozy of a person for you. Welcome to tonight's events with the founder of Leverage Play, the designer behind Diegetic Games, and creator of Story Synth, which we will get into. I would like to welcome to the show Randy Lubin.
Jeremy, thank you so much for having me on. I discovered Draw Your Dice, I feel like, a couple weeks back, and have just loved diving through the archive, and it's just such a good resource to the community. So thank you for having me on, and thank you for the show.
Yeah, of course. Thank you. Thank you for being here. As always, Randy, for those who may not be aware of who you are, would you just give a brief introduction of yourself along with some plugs so that people can find you, get in contact with you, because I can't guarantee that they will make it throughout the entire episode. So I want to make sure they can find you and buy your stuff.
Sure thing. So my name is Randy Lubin. Pronouns are he, him. And I have a bunch of different presences online. So my personal website, randylubin.com, will direct you to other places. My Twitter handle is also at Randy Lubin, and I tend to post about all my things there. But if you want to check out specific projects, Leveraged Play is my serious games consultancy, where I design games for organizations to help them explore the future and explain the present. So you can check out some serious game stuff there. And I also write about it on my blog, which you can get it to at my main site. And then Diegetic Games is my consumer game studio. And it's just about, you know, fun, easy storytelling games, some tabletop, some LARP. And most of those games are also on Itch at randylubin.itch.io. And what other presences do I have? I think that probably has you covered, and you can find other ones from there. Story Synth, as you mentioned, is a web platform I've created to make it as hopefully as easy as possible to go from idea to playing a game if you're making a prompt-driven storytelling game. And you can check that out at storysynth.org, and I'm sure we'll talk about that soon.
Yes. Amazing. And yeah, there's a really helpful intro video over on YouTube on Randy's channel where you can check out how to use Google Sheets or Excel or whatever your sheet choice is and get yourself set up for Story Synth goodness. In addition, Randy, as always, is an additional icebreaker to this show. What has been your path all the way up to sort of Leverage Play and Diegetic Games? You know, what was maybe your first role-playing game that got you really interested in the hobby? And sort of what was the first spark that said, ooh, I could design games?
So I got into designing games pretty much from when I started playing games, or storytelling games. And both sort of came to me a little bit later in life. So my first career, which is kind of still happening a little bit, is in the tech scene. Early stage tech startups helping to make cool new emerging technology do great things for people. And so I moved to San Francisco. I was in my 20s. One of my favorite ways to hang out with people was playing board games. And through that, I kind of discovered two things. One, there were some board games that advertised themselves as storytelling games, but while they were fun to play, didn't tell good stories. And that kind of gnawed at me like, huh, I bet I can make a game that is, like, fun to play, but also yields, like, an interesting story with a good narrative arc and good characters. And at the same time, this is probably, like, late 2013, I played a couple of my first, like, role-playing games. And my entry to the hobby was in the, like, quirky indie side of things. So I think my first three were Fiasco by Jason Morningstar, Microscope by Ben Robbins, and I think a hack of Lady Blackbird by John Harper. Thank you. Yeah, and so, like, my entry was very much the, like, quirky indie bespoke mechanics side of things, which I loved. And so with those two impulses at the same time, the introduction to the tabletop scene and the impulse to create, like, more card games that told good stories, I started working on my first game, which was a game called Plotipus. My collaborator on that is Raph D'Amico, who is currently designing a game called The Zone, which is super cool, and you should have him on the show. And there, from there, it was like, cool, I just designed a thing. It wasn't really in conversation with a bunch of other storytelling game designers. It was just, like, the two of us off in our own world being like, what would make an interesting game? So I, like, look fondly back on that because there aren't strong connections to other streams of design. But in any case, we designed that, we released it sometime in 2014, and from there I started getting a lot more into the indie storytelling game scene, understanding some of the different games and conventions that were happening, and so that was sort of the start of Diegetic Games. I was lucky to find an awesome scene of local designers in the San Francisco Bay Area, and through, like, a quirky startup thing, we had access to this huge Victorian mansion in San Francisco, and would just hold these days, like, once a month or so. I was co-hosting that with Jay Lee of Vermilion Games, and she's just a phenomenal designer, and she was also my, like, gateway to LARP and American Freeform LARP, and that completely blew my mind, because I went from, like, oh, there's this, like, weird, cool tabletop thing, to, like, oh, and you can be embodied and acting, and it, like, scratched this itch for improv and acting that I didn't even know I had. Aww. So that was super cool, and I just got to meet, like, more and more great designers in the Bay Area. And from there, it's, you know, probably around that time, maybe a little bit later, got into the serious games through some friends of mine at a company called Scout.ai, where we'd been talking about games for a while, and I love games, and they had the idea to make a game around elections and how bad actors might manipulate elections and how, more importantly, I guess, how technology intersects with elections. And so we teamed up and created this game called Machine Learning President, which was a, like, mega game. I think we had 50 players playing it. We ended up running it twice. It was an in-person thing. We were running around lots of coalition building. We had a little station that was like an ad buying table with, like, interesting demographic info. We had a tech bazaar. I think it was even like a black market tech bazaar where it was like, oh, here we can get some speculative new tech and figure out how we can use it to influence the elections. And so it was just like this lovely experiment in, like, applied games. We got a bunch of people who would never have described themselves as gamers, and they were LARPing. They were loving hamming it up in character. We did a first run in San Francisco. We did a second run in collaboration with Peter, I'm forgetting his last name, from Wait, Don't Tell Me, in Chicago. And so we flew out, we did that. We had a former U.S. senator show up to that. So it was just like one of those, like, it was started as like a fun project or idea, and suddenly, like, we had some very serious people playing it, and that was just awesome. And so from there, one of my collaborators on that whom I brought in is this guy, Mike Masnick, who is the founder of TechDirt, which is a news site that covers the intersection of tech and policy. It's, I think, one of the best places for really insightful commentary on the intersection of tech and governance and society. And so he and I just started teaming up for game after game that's been on the serious game side. So most recently, we designed a game about the future of money for Mozilla. Prior to that, we did a successor politics game called Threatcast 2020, which was in the lead up to the 2020 election. It was very focused on, like, how might bad actors be using technology in the very near future, and how might we, you know, prevent them from doing so or mitigate the damage. So lots of serious games on that side. And so over the past few years, Leverage Play I've been lucky enough to be able to spend more and more of my time on serious games too, which is just an absolute treat.
Wow. Amazing. Wow. Very, very cool history. One initial question I have, since you came a little later into game design, coming from a tech startup background, we talked a little bit off mic about how you're looking to really add technology to the modern landscape of game design. But what have you found that's been applicable from your tech startup career into game design? Right? Because we're going to potentially talk about something like StageGate later, which I don't know if it, based on the article you sent me, it doesn't seem like it was focused around game design. It seemed focused around very, like, science style iteration. So yeah, what did you find that was applicable from that period of your life into this new period?
Yeah,
of your life?
A ton, actually. And a ton across the board. So I think the two biggest areas there was crossover. One was in the approach to prototyping for a startup and the approach to prototyping and playtesting for a game have tons of crossover. So if I'm working on a startup idea, I will jot down a bunch of directions it might go and then race to test it as fast as possible. And depending on exactly what the idea is, that test might be, it might be just be a survey that's sent out. It might be something I draw with pencil and paper, like if the interface is a key part of it, and I share that with potential users and get their feedback. Or, you know, maybe it's just quickly coding up something that I can then share a link and just, you know, watch somebody screen share as they look through it. But the idea is to like race to as fast as possible, get something that's testable. And sort of adjacent to that, it's focus on the biggest risk first. So in a startup, depending on the idea, the biggest risk might be something technical if you're trying to do something really hard that hasn't been done yet, or it might be something on the market side. You just don't know if users are interested in whatever it is that you're trying to solve their problem with. And so in games, you've much the same thing. So sometimes you might be testing a very tricky new mechanic, and sometimes it's like, well, the rules here are complicated. Am I doing a good job explaining the rules? Or, you know, is this thing balanced? And so again, that combination of like race to playtest as soon as possible. And I'm a huge fan of playstorming, which I think Vidi talked about a few episodes back. Like that, that's just the best. Like bring an idea to the table. It doesn't have to be fully baked. Just start testing. That's not too far off from my attitude towards some startup stuff as well. So that's some of the stuff that I bring over from the tech side. I think the other big category is just thinking things through from a like user experience design. And I think this will probably come up later in conversation too, but like making it so that you're thinking about the user experience from when they first hear about your product or your game through to after the game or the experience of the product live is over, and really thinking about the journey throughout the entire thing and making sure you're best setting up the user or player for success and bringing all of the different design lenses in sort of up and down the design stack from like the very specific visual elements to what they're thinking about when, trying to have a model of like what's their cognitive load, what's their understanding of what they're engaging with, all that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow, that's, I think then what's going to be really cool, I think will be an easy transition is let's get into the meat of some game, right? That game in particular, I think is going to be Behind the Magic for us to start with, because you talked about how you got exposed to the LARP scene, you found out you had an itch for improv that you didn't really know you had before. And it seems like this is also within, like, through play is also like, hey, we're just going to run as many improv scenes raw as we can. Let's just gamify it. So what was the spark for Behind the Magic, as I always start this off?
The spark actually lay in an earlier game I had made for the 200-word RPG design contest, which I'm not sure if it's still going, but for a while it was like a once-a-year-ish thing. You had to compress a whole game into just 200 words and share it, just plain text, which is a wonderful idea for a game jam. And so I had submitted a game called Good Morning Magic Land, which itself was inspired by Hello from the Magic Tavern, which are you familiar with? So a comedy podcast. The idea is, the frame story is that a Earth podcaster from Chicago has fallen through a magical portal, ended up in the magical land of Foon, I think, and is just recording podcasts with the magical creatures and beings that he encounters there. And it's just this wonderful exercise in world building where each guest is effectively building out a new part of the world. And so I was like, oh, cool. How can we empower players to do that same kind of improv storytelling? So Good Morning Magic Land is a 200-word bit of prompt where you're playing like a local access TV channel and just like going from segment to segment to segment, and each segment is building out the world in some funny way. So whether it's a like weather forecast from a barbarian who's talking about some weird weather up in the north or whatever it might be. Yeah.
I love that. And legitimately, I now want to do that for this podcast. Like I want to do some like RPG persona interview. Oh, that could be so much fun.
I lost the thread though. So I realized we're talking about the spark. And so that led me to Behind the Magic. So let me re-tangent back in. So it was like a shower thought of how could I make, because I really enjoyed running and playing Good Morning Magic Land, but the thought was how could I make that into something that had a tighter overall narrative arc and or maybe even a campaign. And that's where, I don't know if I had rewatched it recently, but like I think I was thinking about this is Spinal Tap and like the mockumentary format as just being so perfect for having this kind of comedy and deconstructing a lot of the fantasy tropes.
Yeah. Oh, and it's good. It's good. I mean, my mockumentary experience is like The Office, obviously, for a lot of people. But I also love this one called Documentary Now. That's also a really good mockumentary series specifically. If anyone has watched it, I fucking love Pollo y Arroz, like chicken and rice. That episode is my, because it mocks chef's tables, and I come from like a cooking background. It's so goddamn funny. So yeah, Behind the Magic, walk us through how we play it. Walk us through.
Yeah, so Behind the Magic starts by, actually, one second, let me pull up the game guide, because I haven't run it in a little bit, and I bet I might as well just like that table of contents there.
Absolutely.
So one of the things I did in the design of Behind the Magic, and this is one of the things that I love happens in the LARP world that I'd love to see more in the tabletop world, is having game scripts. So Behind the Magic, the first page of it is a little bit of, the first two pages are some meta information for the facilitator. So like, what kind of space do you need? How much time do you need? How many players? And everything else in there is read aloud during playtime. So you don't even need to read the whole thing in advance if you don't want to. All the information is conveyed. You don't need to worry that as a facilitator, you're leaving anything out. It's just all there. And so in this case, the different beats of it, so I do something that a lot of LARPs do that some RPGs do, which is having some initial workshopping, that being like the general term for how do we prepare to play this game. And that's everything from getting on the same page about the topic, talking about safety, making sure people understand the rules to the extent that they need to. And one of the principles I have in across a lot of my experience design is getting to interactivity as soon as possible. So I'm sure this is different than the initial pass from when I was prototyping Behind the Magic, but it was a lot of like, cool, how do we get people interacting? So it's not just rules, 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 rules. And then, you know, a half hour later, we're just starting to play. So here I cover like, you know, genre and tone and safety, just to get people on the same page. And then it's about choosing the overarching quest. So the frame story for Behind the Magic, you are a group of very incompetent heroes who are in an epic quest to save the world and up in the air whether you're going to succeed or not. So the first part of that is figuring out, okay, what's the quest going to be? And I have a few sample quests topics. So for example, there's an evil necromancer raising an army of the dead. They must be stopped. Or a charismatic bandit is redistributing wealth from the rich to the poor. You must capture them. So there, and one, this also echoes a thing I do a lot where I have five sample quests you can start with, and they're all just one sentence, or you can do your own. And I think so much of my game is like, here's some options, but you're always empowered to do your own. And this, this really hits to like, how do I make games beginner friendly and accessible? And a lot of that is just having powerful defaults that if you have a good idea, you can always diverge from. But like, if you're not feeling as creative, or you just don't know, if you're not ready to take that risk, you can always do something obvious, and that's going to work. See, go ahead.
No, no, I love it. It's what I like. I had Dan Phipps and Colly Laurie on the show earlier, per the recording of this episode, but not out yet. Maybe, I don't know. Time is an illusion, but we were talking about Colly doesn't come from a tabletop background. And so she was saying that a lot of games sort of have this, or at least a lot of the games she was initially exposed to sort of have this subtextual understanding that you've been playing games for the last 10 years. And so you have certain assumptions about how to do things. And Dan and Colly for Gem Room Games talk about how they want to design their games to say, if this is your first game, we're going to hold your hand through it. Like, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And I think that's something to really consider in the modern design landscape, because we're seeing a big swell of people being interested in the tabletop role-playing game hobby in general, even if that is D&D, but D&D in itself is not an easily approached game and makes a ton of assumptions about what you know as a role player, not just on the improv front, but also in the mechanical sense and being able, assuming your cognitive load and everything like that. So what I really love about this game and what you were just speaking to are all these very easy, like, you can make up your own stuff, but this game will walk you from start to finish and you will have a relatively successful finish to your whole experience. So, yeah, didn't mean to cut you off there, but I was just adding that I love it.
It's one of my favorite things to see in games, and I think the whole industry will be so much stronger if there's that much more scaffolding and intentionality into making things beginner-friendly and divorced from the broader context. And that being said, I think it's totally okay for a game to be like, so I'm not someone who's played a lot in the OSR side, but I get the sense that there are a lot of OSR games that the physical game itself or the PDF is almost indecipherable if you haven't been immersed in that play culture. And that's okay, but like, to some degree, I would like for those to like sort of call that out. Like, this is, you're not going to know what to do with this unless you know. And that way people, when they're browsing for things, they see like a game that like has a super awesome cover and has a cool pitch, that they know that like, if they've never played a game before, maybe that isn't the one to start with.
Sure, so, sure. Interesting. I think that's interesting, too. Yeah, exactly. Setting the expectation of like, hey, this is like, I don't know. I don't know if I'm in the wheelhouse of adding ratings to games as far as like expert versus beginner game, right? But I do think there's something to be said about, you know, I'm sure people are scared to do that because like, ooh, those are dollars I'm turning away. But it's like, at the same time, that's also potentially a bad review you're adding to your repertoire, right? So why not set those expectations and then adjust totally. From there?
And I think one of the biggest projects that like we as a scene, as an industry can be working on is like, how do we grow the number of people who are playing storytelling games by 10x, mm-hmm. 100x, 1000x? And like,
yeah.
Expectation setting, proper onboarding, all that goes so long to prevent people from bouncing out and to make it feel like a very approachable hobby.
I love all these sort of like business terms as well, because when you called the workshopping, like the session zero workshopping, I find that to be a much more like indicative, like, again, it's one of those language friendly things where it's like, hey, you're new to a game. You may not understand what the term session zero means, but what we're doing is we're going to workshop the setting together and then we're going to start playing like that sort of. And I love this concept of like onboarding, using the term scaffolding, like all these things are really powerful. And I think it's adjustable language we could start using in our, maybe not necessarily game design, but more in the language in which we present our voice in constructing the text for our game, the copy
totally.
For our game.
A good example of that, and I'm pretty sure I'm getting this right, and I'm sorry if I'm not. So Jason Morningstar has a lot of games that he's designed that feel like they're LARP, or like American freeform LARP, that he stopped calling LARP. He just calls it, this is a storytelling game. You're going to tell a cool story by doing a thing. And I think that's really helpful because people have so many preconceived notions about what an RPG is or what a LARP is. And
yeah.
Especially for his games, which don't cleanly fit into boxes often, just saying, hey, this is a game. And we're going to discover what that means. And we're going to be clear of what we're going to ask of you. But it helps leave some of that baggage at the door.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially for those who are sort of like on the orbiting of the sphere of tabletop games, right? Like, you know, the first time I ever heard someone talk about a LARP game, I immediately thought of, you know, Renaissance reenactment and medieval like spell slinging, the lightning bolt meme and everything like that. And it's so much more than that, as it's been described to me on the show. But, you know, the first time I heard the term, that's what it was, because that's the cultural load I was exposed to, right? So when you try to tell someone new that, hey, we're gonna play a LARP, you're like, oh, do I have to get like a sword or like a helmet or something like that? Like, no, you don't. But they're coming, they're already sort of on the back foot if that is their reaction to the word or the acronym,
right?
Of LARP,
and
right?
There's so much heavier lift at that point, for whether it's the marketing material or the friend who's trying to convince their friend to join.
Yes.
To be like, no, it's not this thing, it's this thing over here, it's different in all these ways. Yeah, it's so much easier to just say, hey, we're gonna play a game and it involves these things.
Yeah. No, it's great. So for this, did you use, I know you said you had some media inspirations for Behind the Magic, but it seems that you've also applied like the, you know, the general narrative structure of the three-act story, right? So was that something that came at first design of the game, or was that something you sort of added later on in the process? Walk me through why you did that.
Yeah, I don't think it was in the very first iteration. And by the way, I think the first playtest I did of this, which was probably like a week after coming up with the idea, was actually tabletop, not LARP. And I think it was either one of the players, mm-hmm. or maybe it was in conversation with Jay Lee, where she was like, Randy, this thing should just be a LARP. It wants to be a LARP. And sure enough, I tested it as a LARP, and it sang that much more beautifully. So I'm not sure if the three-act structure, and the three acts here being like the adventure starts in a specific location, it continues through another location, and finishes at a third. I think the inspiration there was a fewfold. One, I think a lot of movies, whether they're explicitly following a three-act structure or not, have these changes of setting, which also hit slight different changes of tone or show that the story is progressing. So I think it's powerful for that reason. I think it's powerful from an improv perspective in that if you're shifting to a new location, there's new bits to pull on. So for example, if you know, you've suddenly moved from the haunted forest to the floating ruins, you're going to get so many more inspiration for things to draw into your scenes. So I think that was part of it. And also I think the calling out that like there are clear acts will hopefully reinforce these themes of like, no, we're driving toward an end of the story. And that made it really easy. Again, from a scaffolding perspective, there's a sheet in Behind the Magic that has suggested scenes, and there's some like evergreen scenes that can work anytime, but there's also scenes specifically for each act to draw on. So, okay, Act 3, you know, that might be the party's darkest hour, which probably doesn't make sense in Act 1. Or, you know, in Act 1, it's about getting to know each other or traveling through friendly lands. So all of that helped me better build scaffolding to help players make good, obvious choices in their creative play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's true. Another thing that it helped when we talk about the scaffolding, like, people also... Like, one of the examples I bring up often on the show is that the D&D 5e DMG does not teach you how to GM. It teaches you how to make a setting, is what it mostly does, right? But it doesn't teach you about, like... I think it would be really beneficial for people who are newer to GMing or GMing a game to learn about these narrative structures or these narrative structure options, these toolkits, right, that would facilitate you being like, okay, I don't really know what I'm doing, but I know that at some point we're going to have like a pacing change soon, right? Or some, you know, the stakes have to adjust. I have to reintroduce this character or something like that. Just something that could sort of help them along. And what I love about really the whole prompting of where, of how each of those acts feel is really awesome. And the additional thing that I wanted to point out too is that when you say act, like, setting change is also a change of act, I've never really considered that notion before, but I think when I'm starting to think about, like, animes and films in my head where, like, that sort of happens, and it's interesting that it really changes the story. Like, the setting really does change the story, right? Maybe not in my, like, first years of GMing for D&D 5e, maybe that's not something I considered, but there's definitely a leverage where, like, you know, you're in the sleepy rural town with a mystery, right? That's going to add a different context than if you had that same maybe mystery in a ancient ruin with nobody there. So, and that's going to present a lot, like you said, a lot more inspiration to both the players and the GM in that situation to actively separate those things as different story beats, I think is a very interesting concept that I myself am probably going to think about adapting to my own
yes,
style.
Yes, please, steal, remix. There's, yeah, there's another thing I remember that I do here, which is before each act, before each new setting, I ask players to go around and add a sensory description of this new place. So, okay, we're entering the haunted ruins. Mm-hmm. Are you hearing... Yeah, everyone has to add a sight, a sound, a smell. And in addition to helping get people more present in the moment and in the scene and the setting, it, I think, also creates all these bits of story details that might be integrated into later scenes. So if so much of improv and storytelling is the art of reintegration of ideas, the more ideas floating mm-hmm. around there, as long as it's not overwhelming, become just more things to easily riff off of and find beautiful rhymes with as you're telling your story.
Especially when it doesn't come from a single person. I just recently had Tracy Barnett. I just spoke with them Tuesday of the recording of this episode. And we talked about how... Oh, shoot. Just lost my train of thought. What did I just say?
Tracy Barnett. And sensory details? Or maybe participatory world building?
Sensory details. Yeah, so it was about player buy-in. And it's this like, initially, when you're first sort of learning a GM game, let's, you know, D&D 5e will always be the subject of this of these examples because it's, you know, the world's current most popular role-playing game. And D&D is something else other than RPGing. But it is the concept of, like, switching it on its head where the GM is the person who has to give all the detail. They are responsible for the world Bible, right? But I think you create a stronger buy-in for people who get excited about playing stories when you say everyone here has to add a detail to this, whether it's the location, whether it's the NPC that just showed up, right? It's like, if you present those, like you say, reintegration of ideas, everyone gets to say, like, ooh, I helped make this, and now I own a piece of it, right? Like, I have to take ownership and responsibility for this narrative element, right? And I think that's very powerful.
Exactly, exactly. And it also, it provides just another bit of interactivity. So for, if whatever reason... And I've done this different ways in different games, but, like, if whatever reason you're looking to break up a chunk where it's a bunch of rules or exposition, or perhaps if it's a bunch of scenes and somebody might not be present for a couple scenes, it's just a way to get even a light bit of interactivity so nobody's sitting for too long without doing something and contributing to the story.
Yeah, I had, oh shoot, Andy Burdan. Yes, Andy Burdan. And we talked a little bit in his episode about post-elimination mechanics. So the difference of, like, the example of poor post-elimination mechanics is something like Werewolf or Town of Salem, where you're just sort of like, you're still in the game, but you're forced to watch until the end. And that's not necessarily fun. But instead, games like Blood, mostly pointed at social deduction games or elimination style games, but like Blood Under the Clock Tower has a mechanic where if you die, if you are eliminated from the play group, you still get one vote left as a ghost, and you still get to contribute to clues about your role or other things you've heard that other people are saying that may be untrue, even though you've been removed from the game. So like, when you have these, when you think about where are the moments in my game that I've built in that there is a lull, and can I keep someone even lightly engaged the whole time, right? By giving them something to add to the scene. You know, I think about there's a homebrew rule I once read for D&D 5e that someone made up where they call it spiritual rallying, where like if the party splits up, you can have like a very small quip of like two sentence scene where they're like, man, I was really impressed by Gorgog's strength earlier in the chamber, and then you can use that to give them inspiration, right? Give them that advantage on their next die roll. So it's like you can still be interacting four rooms away, breaking meta, whatever. I don't know. I don't care about meta. But, you know, it's that concept of keeping people engaged when you split them up. And I think the most attractive moments that I can think of in my playing career is when, you know, two people are having an endearing scene, but not everyone likes to just watch. You know what I mean? Like, not everyone likes to watch the TV show unfold. So figuring out how to add ways to keep them engaged is very cool. And I love that you did that.
I think that's awesome. And some other examples of games that do that well, I feel like, I mean, Blades in the Dark having flashbacks as a core, like, written to the rules thing, I think is a brilliant approach. And I think games that allow players to come in as NPCs is really helpful. So in Behind the Magic, very much be pulling people in who their main characters aren't in the scene as NPCs, and that's really fun. And then, to some degree, like, the extent that you're encouraging play to lose, then everything that you've just talked about is that much more important. Like, I've had Behind the Magic games where people will kill their character off in Act 1 and then haunt the party as a ghost or come in as a series of different NPCs. Oh, my favorite was someone who, I wish I could credit who it was, I forgot who did it, but they were playing just, like, a random peasant villager, and the running joke became that they kept being killed, and they kept being killed and replaced by one of their brothers or sisters who had a, like, very similar sounding name. And so, like, by the end of pretty much every scene they were in, someone from their family would die at least once. This became just, like, this reoccurring motif, which just, yeah.
I love that. That's so hilarious. It was me all along. I would love for that.
I think they may have joined the villain in the end. sorry. One last example here of games that do that well.
Yeah.
So Archipelago, which is a GM-less game, does a really great job of this, because at any point when somebody can say, that's not so easy, and then you pull a card from the not so easy deck, which complicates things and says, oh, that thing you're trying to do, yes and or no but or some combination of that. And again, everyone's engaged, because even if you're not directly in the scene, you could always be looking for a place to be like, ooh, maybe we can complicate this in an interesting way. Maybe we can send something off on a tangent. So giving people that, like, narrative agency is just also, like, awesome. Because now you're always paying attention, because there's always a time to meddle with the narrative.
Yeah, I love those sort of, like, metal mechanics. Ooh, that would be, it makes me, whenever I have these talks, especially talks sort of focused on the player experience, not just the game in itself, but talk about player experience as the umbrella of the subject, I always think about how, you know, if there was ever going to be a D&D 6e that wasn't made by the same people who've been making the game for the last 10 years, what would it look like if that player experience was thought of and then adding these sorts of components to the game? I don't know, I think about all these things we're talking about, I was like, there could be so much more fun to be had that isn't like the 2-hour slog of wargaming that's forced into the game. Where people, there are so many people who say they love D&D for the role playing, and that's very valid, but that's not what the game does. You're doing all the heavy lifting for that. The game does not help you tell those stories. It just helps you whittle down HP and talk about life.
Right.
Or death.
If you're a novice GM or at a table of all beginners, you're then really unsupported, and hopefully you're able to pull out a great improvised experience. But yeah, I think in an ideal world, people are super supported to tell the types of stories they want to be telling, and there's, like, real harmony between the rules and mechanics and the experience that's desired.
You're good. You're good. You're strong.
So yeah, so Behind the Magic ended up in this place where you could tell a pretty compact fantasy mockumentary comedy in about 90 minutes of playtime, plus maybe a half hour of workshopping. Really happy with where it ended up, and definitely best played embodied, where you can really ham up and chew up the scenery and knock over chairs or whatever it might be. But it can be played online. And I've been lucky enough to see a few streamers play it, and it's the kind of thing that does translate to Zoom, because you can always sort of just fall back to hamming it up and emoting and just saying what your character does, and that totally works too. So at some point I was tempted early in the pandemic to remix this into something that was specifically meant for video chat. And my working title for that was Scry Scry Again, where you're all using like crystal balls to look at the heroes. I got torn and away to do story synth work instead because I got really excited about that. But I might return to Scry Scry Again at some point.
Oh, that'd be so good. And also great names, by the way. Behind the Magic and Scry Scry Again. Very good. I don't know if you have like a team workshop or anything like that, but very good. Well, let's break up the mechanical talk a little bit. Usually this is the trend spot, but we had an interesting subject we kind of want to get into, and I want to learn about as your application of it. What is, Randy, what is stage gate design?
Oh, love stage gate design. So stage gate design, and I to give credit, I originally encountered it through Daniel Cook's blog, Lost Garden. Daniel Cook's a video game designer who also, I believe, runs the Horseshoe Workshops. So Horseshoe Workshops, a bunch of game designers get together and write these super long essays on topics like what are cozy games and game mechanics that promote coziness in games. Anyway, check out Horseshoe. But Daniel Cook's blog has a lot of interesting thoughts on game design process, and that's where I discovered StageGate. So StageGate is a process for coming up with and refining game ideas and taking them to market. I think it originally originated in industry and like a portfolio of product management, but the simple bit of it is that you're starting with a lot of very, very simple ideas and pitches, and over successive rounds, refining those ideas, building them up, and most importantly, filtering out the ones that aren't quite fitting what you want. And the idea is that by going really broad and starting with lots of ideas, you're more likely to hit something that's amazing. You're more likely for different ideas you have to be good for cross-pollination and remixing. And most importantly is that you're not investing a ton of work down a path that might ultimately be a dead end. So I use StageGate the most in the serious games part of my design life, but I'll also use it for some consumer games if I don't know exactly the direction to go in. And my personal take on it, so every stage has a different sort of form factor as I do it, and a different gate to that, you know, different type of hurdle to pass to make it onto the next stage. So for me, it starts with a lot of like, let's just get fragments of ideas. So not even a cohesive game pitch, but what might be a cool mechanic? What might be a really interesting narrative beat or moment? What might be a feeling or sensation that I want players to have during the game or maybe walk away from? Also during this time, I'll try and write out some goals to help reel the game in scope. So for example, I might say this definitely needs to be an RPG or needs to be a LARP, or on the serious game side, maybe this needs to work for 15 to 30 players, or it needs to last, you know, at most 2 hours, those types of things. And one of the reasons I love this, and especially the first couple stages of the stage gate, is I can run through a client who maybe is not a game designer, maybe hasn't played that many games. And it's a great way to do still some collaborative design, because they are so free to just throw out lots of ideas too, riff off of my ideas. And also I can tease out their preferences as we talk through what things at different parts of the funnel are interesting to them and why. And so if the first stage is just throwing out these little fragments, the next stage of the stage gate is condensing these fragments into sentence pitches. So a sentence pitch probably has, this is going to be a LARP, and the players are going to fall into factions and hear roughly what the factions are, and we're maybe going to have a little bit of game state or something like that. And the idea is that, you know, I might go from, you know, 20 to 50 idle, like, little fragments of a game idea to maybe 10 to 20 sentence level pitches. And now we can suddenly start trading off, well, I really like what this part of this one, this part of this other one, maybe we can remix it into another pitch. And that starts, you know, that's where it starts to gel in our minds of like, oh, maybe there's something really interesting down this path or that path. And so once we get a bunch of really good sentence pitches down, the next stage in the stage gate is paragraph pitches or like a sentence and then an outline. And that's for me, like where it starts hitting the interesting points of like, okay, what are the tensions and the trade-offs? So something that might be a really good one sentence pitch, when you start to say, okay, well, what would the game structure be? Or what are players actually doing? That then suddenly either go, you come up with a bunch of really cool ideas, or you might say, huh, well, I'm kind of stumped here because it was a fun sentence pitch, but maybe it doesn't really work in practice. But because we're now designing it in just a, you know, half page tops length, it's not that we're investing in running in something that we're going to take all the way to playtest, especially something that might, you know, if we're running a playtest and we need 10 people, that's like a lot of work on our part. So the more we can be testing at the early stage, the better. So these, you know, paragraph or half page length, just the sort of sketches of what the game might look like, are so good at saying, okay, you know, now I'm getting a clear picture, distinct picture of what this game might look like in play in reality. And ideally, we're coming up with then like 3 to 5 of those and having a really good conversation around the trade-offs. And again, hopefully like ideas we have for one might be repurposable for another. And from there, the next stage is coming up with like a game script. And this could be a like one page bulleted outline. It could be something a little bit bigger. Sometimes I'll switch from doing all of this in parallel to just doing one at a time at this point. It depends on how much conviction I have and the client has around like, oh, this is the path forward. But depending on the game, and this is especially true on the consumer side, this is where I'll bring in playstorming. I'll say, okay, cool. We now have like a one page outline of what might this game be. Let's try it out. And so playstorming for a consumer game might be like, let's just dump a bunch of material on the table and play it out. If it's a serious game or simulation, sometimes it'll be, okay, we're going to talk through what we think the different players or the different factions might do at every point. And some of the key questions there, do people always have interesting decisions to be making? Is there interesting tension? Do they have the right context and information? And sometimes, you know, in this design process, we'll realize like, oh, well, this one player or this one faction, I'm not really sure what their goal is at this point. And at that point, we need to back up and say, well, is this the right framing? Or how can we provide better scaffolding? All those sorts of questions. So, you know, if this stage is like the outline stage and we're either talking through play in like a granular level or we're playtesting, then once we have some confidence, ideally by the end of that one, we know, okay, here's the rough direction of one specific pitch that we're going in. Let's go and start refining. And then the stages from there are probably not too surprising to anyone who's designed, but then you're coming up with an earlier draft, you know, light drafts to more polished drafts. Depending on the arc of the game, it might be good enough to have just a rough facilitator run of show guide or script because it's never going to be published. Or it might be that, you know, first, if it's something that will end up being published, usually my like sequencing for what I want to de-risk is, okay, first I just need something that I personally can run. It could be indecipherable to somebody else. Then I need something that someone else can run, maybe with me present to fill in the blanks. And then finally, something that ideally I could just fly on the wall or they can record and share with me later. And I don't know if that works. And to sort of look back, that's like, first it's testing, like, is there something fun here? And the second is like, do the rules work, you know, once I've honed in on the fun? And then not just do the mechanics work, but are they explained in a way that's accessible is the third. And again, sort of with the principle of like, work on where the biggest risk is first and do as much as you can with doing as little work as possible to learn and optimize on learning. Like that's where like the repeated layers of playtesting or playstorming, I think, are so effective because you get to explore a lot more space and you get to save a bunch of time that might have been wasted down a dead end path.
I filled up a whole note card. Here we go. No, this is very cool. So I'm a very structured style thinker. Like, I love the guideline of a process. I love being able to repeat a process to do something. I don't have, while I have good idea pulling from the atmosphere that is my brain, I cannot connect those dots without some sort of structure. So I love this. I love this concept. For maybe the people at home, could we, like, I don't know, find a random word and maybe do a small run through of this real quick? Is that possible? Do you feel like that's doable?
Yeah, sounds good. At least for the early stages, we can definitely
yes,
do that.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, no, let's go full play storming and just find people on the street.
So better yet, we can do it. Is there a piece of media you've consumed recently, whether a movie or a book or something that you really loved and you think like, oh, there should be a game?
Oh, the Demon Slayer anime, I think, is really cool. They have like this power, like breathing techniques and stuff like that. It's very like feudal Japan samurai with magic fantasy and demons layered over it.
Cool. So if we were to make a game around this, immediately we have a bunch of genre trappings and setting. I think the other pieces that might be interesting are like, what is this something that you want as a campaign or a quick one shot? And maybe the answer is we can explore both, or maybe we lock that in and that's one variable we're not experimenting with.
Definitely something campaign. I see some like progression or power growth things that happen in this.
Cool. So if power growth's important, Like these are all things that you could sort of like write at the top of the page. Like here are the things that I know I want in this. So, you know, I can explore beyond the bounds a little bit, but I'll cut things out at different stages if they're not meeting and aligned with those goals. So, right. So then the next step would be, okay, cool, let's brainstorm a bunch of mechanics that we might want in here. And some of it might also be like, what are the types of scenes and beats? Like, is this a game where there's a lot of violence and physical conflict, or is it really about emotional stories and growth? And let's make sure we're building mechanics that support those.
It is both, for sure. There are definitely daring battles, but the main protagonist of the show kind of sees the depth of the people who've been turned into demons, and he sees them for the people they were before they enact in all this, you know, predatory practice.
Ooh, very cool. So some of the things that I'd start jotting down is like, okay, cool. So there's this element of like who they were and who they are now. And like, you know, so one fragment might be like, is this a game where there's lots of flashbacks where you're meeting characters and then flashing back to see who they were before they became this demon form? Another, on the mechanic side, I think there's interesting bits. Like I am a big fan of like everything is a remix. Everything humans do is a remix. And so to the extent that there's like things you can pull on in the game design world that makes sense to remix in, at least as like jumping off points. So like, you know, I think that's where, like, this one in particular, I have no idea what would be the right fit, but writing down, like, oh, you know, maybe is there an interesting, you know, what would this look like if it was a belonging outside belonging game with tokens? Or maybe there's a path where it's like, what would this game look like if, so I'm not sure how the show's framed, but, like, so there's one central character who's the...
Yeah, and then there are, like, some nice supporting characters that have their small, like, offshoot stories and things like that as well.
Cool. So I could see a game, like, what if this was GMless and it was all the supporting characters and you're kind of taking time turns with all the supporting characters, but that one central character is shared by everyone.
So this is very much like the fragment style of things. We're putting some like keywords down and saying like, this is all the stuff we want here. And then we have like some goals, like we want campaign play, at least initially, right? We want some campaign play. I feel like this is a tabletop role-playing game because there's like power progression stuff. I don't know if in the LARP world that also exists. There's like a progression style of LARP game, but
that is, there is, but I'm not at all familiar with it. It's there's a campaign LARP is a whole school. LARP is such a big diverse thing, and I'm not familiar with it, but it is very much a thing.
Heard. Good to know. So then we would also use these goals to sort of decide like what may or may not work. So we would move into like the condensed version, right? We would let's axe the GMless, right? Like, let's say the GMless isn't going to make it to the next stage and we start doing these condensed pitch. So we're left with sort of these mechanics of like figuring a flashback of like who they are or who they were, who they are now. Maybe let's say we stuck with the token-based belonging outside belonging system, right? Because they use breath, so we can instigate that with conceptually as stamina or something like that, right? What would this stage look like here? We would just say like, this is a game that uses tokens to represent breath styles. I know you may not necessarily know what that means. For anyone that's listening and doesn't know what Demon Slayer is, great anime. I highly recommend it. It's got a great story and it does some interesting things with the shonen genre. But what would we do here in the condensing stage?
Yeah, so it sounds like, okay, part of the story is, okay, you've got that mechanic bit down. And so that's like half of maybe a sentence prompt. And the other prompt is like, cool. And maybe if there's a campaign, the core loop of a session is all built around, again, I don't know the anime, but maybe it's about one major encounter between one of these side characters and one of the main characters. Or,
sure.
You know, and so it's like a little bit of like, what's the shape of one unit of experience? Like the smallest unit of experience that's satisfying on its own. And again, maybe there's some different theories. Like maybe at this stage you have a few different sentence prompts and one is focused on like really zoomed in where one session is equivalent to one episode if the episodes have similar structure. And maybe another one is like, no, one session might be an entire season and this is really going to cover a ton of ground and have a much more epic scope. So you might then come up with like a few different ones that are both different permutations on like what does the structure look like and what, you know, is it about tokens that are really zoomed in on the stamina or is it some other set of game state that really matters?
Yeah, like the figuring out who they are, like using the tokens also not only as a space of physical feat, but also as a space for like figuring out or tapping in to the empathy of your opponent or another character, right? I think that could also be an interesting component there mechanically, but also setting wise.
Totally. And again, this is me not totally knowing the anime itself, but maybe there's something.
Grain of salt, like, everyone, grain of salt.
Right. But I could see forks where it's like, okay, these NPC characters, these more minor side characters, are they, are we quickly churning through them where we're, there's a lot of like play to lose, like where they're going to, they might die, but that's okay because it's going to tell a good story. Or are these characters we definitely want sticking around? And like, so that's maybe another design fork. And then another design fork might be like, okay, are we mostly keeping our, everybody keeping the same side character? Or is it that we're all pulling them out of a pool in the beginning and rotating around? And I think like these are all fun design fork questions. One of the things I love doing, and it's, I think it works very well within the stage gate approach, is just noting here are all the design forks where I had at least two interesting ideas, but I decided to go down one. Let me flag the other because, you know, if I hit a dead end later, I can just come back and be like, oh, well, I'll just try it this other way.
So then from this stage, we'd move into sort of the paragraph pitch. This is something where like, I don't know, maybe it's on the back of the book or, you know, the idea is that it's on the back of the book and sort of gives an idea of what the game is, right? So this is a game where you play demon hunters who are trying to discover, rid the world of demons, but do it in an empathetic manner because that's what our troop does, right? Like that sort of, would that sort of elicit this sort of third step?
Yes. And I think depending on the depth you want to go into, so there's no canonical stage gate stages. So I think that could be its own step. And depending on your goals, like if you were trying to get potential players or feedback from potential players or collaborators, or maybe fans of the anime, or maybe people who've never heard of the anime, but seeing if it still resonates, that's a perfect shareable thing that you can just be like, hey, does this pitch interest you? Or do you prefer this other pitch over here? Like, I'd love feedback. So you could, you definitely do that as a stage, or you can sort of skip slightly further ahead and have that same detail, but then also have a few bullet points. Like, so the bullet point, like in a given session, the following things happen in sequence. First you do activity phase one, then activity phase two, then activity phase three, or whatever it might be.
Interesting. And then you would write out the game script from this point forward, sort of like more an elongate, like you have a set of rules or mechanics that people can play with and instill with. And this is the, if you run it, like if it's indecipherable to everyone else, but maybe you and you run it and it sort of executes, and you're basically at this point now playstorming and reworking it until it gets to a state where it can be run without you, and that's like something to really start iterating upon, right? Is that sort of the framework?
Exactly. And I would say that that first thing, you don't, depending on what you're trying to do and if you have collaborative partners or not, you don't even need to have a game script. You can kind of just gather some friends and be like, I'm going to dump a bunch of tokens on the table and we're just going to, I have this thing that's half baked in my head. We're going to see where the fun is. My favorite things I do, and one of the reasons I love playtesting so much and playstorming so much, is get a game in front of a strong table of players and see what they do, especially if it's underbaked, and figure out what are the natural impulses that they're doing as storytellers, as improvers, and then thinking, okay, how do I empower any table, a table full of beginners who've never played a game before, to make some of the same like bold creative choices and have some of the same amazing narrative beats? And I think this is like a paving the cow path kind of thing of just like, cool, see what they do, make it so that anyone can do it. So I think almost every game I've made has elements of this. So like Behind the Magic, my guess is I had plenty of moments where somebody came up with a really great character concept, and then I just added that to the list of like possible characters to do, or likewise, you know, villains or scene beats or whatever it might be.
Interesting. That's what a smart way to do that too, because you're sort of leveraging the combined perspective and experience of multiple people who have maybe played, I don't know, I'm making up a number for the sake of this hypothetical, but they've each played 30 different games that don't overlap at all, and you're trying to see where that experience brings into what feels like a strong version of play, right? And then you want to take those examples and place them in your design so that you can help others replicate that strong experience.
Totally. And it's not just games they've played, it's, you know, movies they've watched, books they've read, and maybe things they've written too, because all of this just becomes great, great remix fodder. I would say another thing I'll do, depending on the game, if it's specifically a game that's trying to tap into a genre, then I'll read the TV tropes page for that genre and like all of the links that come off that, because that usually has so many good examples of like the iconic beats. And I think it's interesting, you know, if you're doing a non-interactive story medium, it's usually good to like shy away from like the biggest cliches. But if you're doing something interactive, those cliches become a moment of recognition where everyone's like, oh, we did the thing that the genre does.
Interesting. I've never really thought about it that way, but that's a really good point that, like, because the first time I was ever exposed to the concept of, like, putting touchstones in a book was Blades in the Dark. Like, here's some media points that we can all point to and say, hey, if we watch these things, we will have a really good idea of what this game is supposed to do, right? So to put in something, obviously cliches that are non-harmful to people at the table, right? But to use these sort of cliche or trite tropes that you might avoid in like novel writing or filmmaking. It helps everyone maintain a same page experience and know, and it may also help other players riff because it's like, oh, I totally see what you're doing right now. And I totally know how to help you feel good here. Right. Like it's that moment as well.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. Any closing thoughts for StageGate now that we sort of like have run through it?
I think the main closing thought here is that it's flexible and it's there to be of help to you. So to the extent that you want to add stages or reduce stages or skip stages, that's totally fair. It's like it mm-hmm. is a tool and a process that is there for you to adapt. But whenever you're struggling with a blank page and not sure what direction to take things in, or you're trying to collaborate with someone and you want a little bit of extra help making sure you're on the same page or making sure both of you have lots of room to have your voices heard, it's a great place to turn to first, because it's just it gets you moving, it gets you pushing forward, and it gives you the freedom to say, I'm going to throw things out here and then I might completely discard it. So bad ideas are so welcome, because some bad ideas turn out to be great ideas.
Yeah, there's before ending this particular segment, there's a, who is it? Bob? Robert? It's called The Yard Sale, and it's by someone who was working on the BioShock 2 game. Stand by. Jeremy, edit this silence out real quick, but I want to make sure I get this name right. The Yard Sale. Hello? Oh, haha, I turn off the Wi-Fi on my iPad, lol. Sorry, thank you for your patience, Randy.
I'm really curious, Joe.
The Yard Sale, game design, BioShock. Zach McClendon. He did a talk at Practice 2018. He does, so this, what you're talking about is sort of similar to how he approaches the yard sale, which is he takes his entire collaborative crew, puts them in a room, gives them a bunch of sticky notes. I believe this is done also in like boardroom or management meetings or leadership meetings where people are trying to figure out what direction to maybe take the next fiscal year or something like that. But it says, you know, this is a section for mechanics, this is a section for setting, and just starts doing like the fragment stage, right? Starts everyone keep writing post-it notes, keep putting things up there. And then once all of it's up there, once everyone's drained of ideas for all this conceptual work, they start organizing them and ordering them into like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in a rating system. And there may be 32 ideas for one section, but only 5 are going to be the most important. And they'll spend maybe like a month or so, 2 weeks. I don't know. I don't remember what the deadline for BioShock was, but I think it's like anywhere from 2 weeks to a month of like just organizing or rating these things to find like basically a distillation of these ideas and saying, this is what the game is, because this is what we can realistically do in our time span. And this is also, this will also create the strongest experience. And they'll revisit that board and they may reorder things as they iterate on the process. But the StageGate reminded me of the yard sale by Zach McClendon. So I'll put both a link to the original article for the StageGate by, what was his name again?
Daniel Cook at Lost Garden.
Daniel Cook at Lost Garden, and the Practice 2018 talk by Zach McClendon. I think both of those will be very valuable to add to the designer toolkit. I know it is for me, so no reason it's not for someone else out there. I'm having a blast. Are you having a blast? I'm having
so much fun. Like, this is, I can talk about game design endlessly, and you have such thoughtful questions and extra context to add. This is a treat for me.
Thank you. That will bring us now, Randy, into talking about Premise, which is sort of a, what I like to dub as a framework game, which I love, love, love framework games. I think they're very, very cool. But why don't you tell everyone what Premise is real quick, because you're a designer and you'll do a better job than I will.
All right, sure. So Premise is a collaborative game that you will be together building and riffing on each other's ideas to come up with something probably weirder and more novel than any one of you would have come up with on its own or on your own. And the way it works is everyone has starts with a template in front of them. And there's three ways of playing Premise. You can do a setting, character, or a plot. And you'll all start out with the same sheet, and you can chain them together into rounds. But you'll all start with a setting sheet in front of you, and at the same time, you'll all start filling in a top-level pitch. So is this an abandoned base on Mars? Is this a beautiful post-utopia powered by magic? Whatever it is. And so everyone's writing simultaneously, so you might have all these different genres and settings all at the same time. And once everyone's done with the high-level pitch, you pass your page to the right, and you now answer the next box on the page. So if you're looking at the page, it's a sequence of these boxes with prompts. And so some of the boxes are like, what are the important factions here? What's a central conflict? What are the sights? What are the sounds? And so the way the game is played, you're just constantly rotating through, reading what was on the page already and adding to it. So maybe you had given me a pitch of the abandoned base on Mars, and I'll say the central conflict is, you know, maybe it's haunted by the ghosts of the Martian pioneers who died here. And then I'll then pass it to the next person who might elaborate with some sights and sounds. And the idea is that you just keep going and elaborating and until you get to the end, and then you share back with everyone what each of the settings turned out to be. And there's this wonderful delight of, oh, I started it thinking it might go in this direction, but people just took it in this cool, weird other place. And there's this super delightful moment of just seeing which bizarre, cool ways things went. And the main inspiration for this was Exquisite Corpse, which
I was about to say, yeah.
Yeah. So Exquisite Corpse, for listeners who are not familiar, is a game that was originally pioneered by the French surrealists in like the 20s or 30s. And in that game, you start with a piece of paper and you, in the top third of the paper, start a drawing and have the lines from that drawing just slightly overlap below the top third line. And then you pass it on to somebody else who continues. Yeah, in that case, you fold over the top third of the paper and then continue the drawing for the middle section, and then somebody else does the bottom section. And again, the idea was like, let's provoke ourselves to make things that are beyond and weirder than any one person would be coming up with. So yeah, Exquisite Corpse, huge inspiration here.
And you do it in Premise, you do it for both setting, character, and plot. I would say yes, but do you feel like this is a tool that people can leverage when they're starting a game? Like if they have, if this is Blades in the Dark, and we knew what the setting was, but we wanted to add some locations, or we wanted to add something special for us to explore in the world. Do you think people could use this in that same medium?
Very much so. And I think it's written into the rules that you're highly encouraged to adapt and remix this. So because setting is fractal, a setting could be a galaxy, or it could be a convenience store, or it could be, you know, just the inside of somebody's body, who knows, that... Yes, you can do it to create neighborhoods in Blades in the Dark. You could do it to, let's stick with Blades in the Dark as an example. You could totally create a ton of NPCs by just playing character. So the three different modes of play, setting, character, and plot, are, you can easily just sit down and just do one of them, or just do one, in the middle of the rest of your game without touching anything else. I could see for a storytelling game, let's say you're doing a campaign and you've just arrived at a new location because you're traveling, and this is a great way of, even if it's a more traditionally GM'd game, of sharing narrative agency and responsibility, saying, cool, well, before our next session, because a session of Premise, just one of character setting or plot, takes maybe 30 minutes, maybe a little less. So you easily could say, cool, before we start the session, we're going to play Premise character and create a bunch of NPCs that we're probably going to encounter over the course of the session.
I love it. I love these games because they help me. Again, I'm one of those people who like structures, who like templates, who like frameworks. I cannot create in a nebulous space. I know there are people out there who can. I am not that person. So I love when things like this exist. In fact, I was trying to make something similar to this maybe 7 months ago, 8 months ago. I wanted to make like a campaign helper template for new GMs. And this is amazing. And now I'll just recommend this to people. So to get you that money, I don't see why I would need to reinvent the wheel on this one.
What are some other framework games that you love? Because you call this a framework game. I'd love to hear your definition and some other games you think exemplify it.
Yeah, so Tyler Kremrine's Beak Feather and Bone is a really great example of a framework game because it allows you to build up a location through history. There is another one called Apotheosis by Gordy Morphy. That one tries to examine the process and evolution of telling an oral story that doesn't get written down. So like urban legends and stuff could also be an example of this. There is also The King's Domain. No, what is it called? I literally just bought it, but it's by Sealed Library, aka Matt Sanders, and it is on my itch. Standby. Maybe I'll just leave Google Chrome up. I just don't want my computer to scream at me. You have too many processes. My library. Dead Emperors, which has you make a kingdom. So those are like what my definition of a framework game is. Something where you can play, you gamify the traditional GM experience and sort of create guidelines and tools that maybe more traditional games are not providing you. I know that, like, again, the example, D&D 5e, the DMG, it has like villain prompts and setting prompts and gives you like some planes that you can explore. But I feel like those things are just a little too loose. They don't have you answer sort of the more foundational questions to... There's another game, Tracy Barnett's You Are the Dungeon. A lot of the time when I first started playing D&D, and, you know, it's a classic dungeon crawl game. You know, you meet in a tavern, you get hyped up, and then you go steal from other civilizations. And... But the thing that isn't really thought about is what was the dungeon before it was a dungeon? Like, nice.
It was
a castle that is now ruined after 500 years of erosion and tear. And it has been populated for whatever reason by all of these things. And that gives you, thinking about that, gives you way more flavor to operate off of when you get the players in there, right? You don't have to now explain why there are a bunch of gob manticore and a ooze here, because the ooze got there because the castle's irrigation system was connected through the farmland and now that's closed off, but the ooze can't get out now, so now it's just living here, and all those sorts of concepts, right? And those are my examples of framework games that I use.
Love and it. This and certainly fits in them. Harkening back to our earlier conversation, the players have more buy into the game because they've helped create the setting. There's more bits for people to riff off of. So even if the GM hasn't mentioned something being present in a scene, players might remember, like, oh, isn't there this other thing we can now reincorporate and riff off of? So absolutely love it. Two others I'll throw out. So I think Microscope is great at building out, like, a timeline history. And then Dialect by Kate and Hakan at Thorny Games is through exploring the culture and language that emerges. So it's a game where you create a... Tell the story of the creation and decline of a language. And it is just, it is such a beautiful game. And it works really well in this framework way. So you can totally play a round of this to build out some of the world and then set another story in that world.
Ooh, I may have to get this. Darn. You're hearing it live. I'm spending money for the first time. Awesome. Very cool. Yeah, I love Premise. I think it does really cool things for people who may have a harder time getting into sort of that improv space. And I think what it also, your game specifically, helps people learn to create buy-in. Like, it gives them permission to express themselves. Because I think one of the traditional thinkings or teachings, especially when we, again, D&D 5e, is like the GM holds all the power and you can't really speak up outside of the agency of your own player. And even like more modern takes on what it means to GM for D&D still doesn't really give you the permission to be like, yeah, you know, this is a temple to my god. I would love, you know, if I'm playing a cleric or a paladin or whatever, I would love to make sure that there's a bunch of a druid in my druid's grove. I'm exploring an ancient grove that belonged to one of my ancestors. I would love to see some of our flowers here, right? The GM may not necessarily be thinking of that, but you as the player who cares about that space should be willing or should be able to add that detail to make it more important for you and make it more evocative for everyone else at the table. And it also takes cognitive load off of the GM who's already spent maybe 30 minutes trying to concoct this space improvly if they're not a prepper, and maybe even like they're tired from prepping all week and stuff like that. So I think it's important to play games, gamify, or introduce the permissions to say everyone gets to create something at the table, not just the player you're playing, not just the avatar sleeve you're wearing.
Totally. And you know, one other thing that is interesting. It wasn't part of the initial design inspiration, but it sort of emerged and is something I think is cool to reincorporate into other designs is the fact that because you're all sort of simultaneously doing this writing and you're quickly creating a bunch of content, I think in a given session, you're coming up with, I don't know, 7 or 8 things per sheet, per template. Mm-hmm. And because you're coming up with so many and you're constantly having to pass it around and then start on a new one, it's kind of freeing and liberating, because if I don't have something really creative to do for a given rectangle, I can just put something obvious or a clear, just like next step forward extension of what's previously written. And that's okay, because somebody else is going to get to it next and they might have a wild idea of where else to take it. And you know what? I'm about to see an entirely new sheet, and that might give me inspiration to do something really out there. And the idea that like you can, you know, you're free to take really cool creative risks. And if it's too wild and out there, it kind of doesn't matter because there's a bunch of other content coming around too. And if it's the other direction, it's not that interesting, that's okay, because somebody else is going to step in and do something interesting. So it's like an incredibly forgiving space for taking creative experimentation.
Very powerful. Very powerful stuff. I highly recommend, like, my other, like, term for them is like toolbox games, but this is definitely a toolbox game that people should add for sure. I think it's something that they should use at the table in between sessions. What's also cool about these framework games is that they're usually almost always designed, because you talked about how each section of yours can be played in 30 minutes, right? A lot of these framework games don't take very long to play at all. Like Apotheosis takes maybe 30, 45 minutes. Beak Feather and Bone can take anywhere from 30 minutes to an hour, unless you want to play it like campaign style. And so what's nice about them is, you know, if you want to keep the juice going and you want to play all week, but you don't have a lot of time, you can do this outside of the game and still feel like you're attached to playing, and it almost elongates the experience for those who are able to do so. I understand not everyone's able to do that, but it could also be something that you do at the tail end of a session or right before a session. Like, hey, we're about to go into this place. Let's do a quick little run of You Are the Dungeon and let's make a dungeon, right? And I think that stuff is very powerful, and I think it should definitely be leveraged more in sort of the constant workshopping of your campaign, right? I think it keeps the energy high for that experience. Great. I think that's good, unless you have a closing thought for Premise.
Yeah, I'll throw some closing thoughts. So you can get Premise on Itch, randylubin.itch.io. And if you get it, it comes with Google Slides. So there's the printed version. Hopefully soon it'll be safe for everyone to play the printed version around a table with friends. And there's something really fun to that, like, hushed, everyone's like sort of scribbling and then occasionally cracking up when they see what somebody else has written energy to it. But there's also a Google Slide format. And so you can totally just play it in Google Slides. Everyone just sort of rotating through the slides. That works really well for remote play. The other thing I'll throw out with Premise is I've used it as part of creative writing workshops. So I've teamed up with folks to do like a speculative futures writing. And so, for example, I did it with the Foresight Institute, where we were talking about extremely hopeful futures. And what we did is we played a round of Premise setting first to zoom into like what different aspects of a very positive future that's been transformed by technology might look like. And that was the first half of the workshop, and the second half was then writing bits of short stories set in those worlds. And so really great at just creating fodder for other activities, whether they're other games or fiction writing or something completely different.
So good. And you know, I am a sucker for solar punk, so that sounds cool to me, and I can't wait to see those speculative fictions for sure. Great. Well, then, usually at the end here, Randy, I do a TLDR tip, but I think there's something we want to talk about, right? Yes, yeah. I didn't forget. It's just on the end here. Let's talk about what is StorySynth.
So StorySynth, as I think I said at the top of the show, is hopefully the easiest way to go from idea to playing a real game that you've designed in the browser. And specifically, it's for prompt-driven storytelling games. Mm-hmm. The types of games that inspired it are For the Queen or The Quiet Year, where you have a deck of prompts that have been shuffled up. And my goal for the design process here was, this StorySynth I started working on last summer, and so couldn't do any playtests in person. That was definitely slowing down my, you know, the velocity of which I was designing and shipping games. And so my thought was like, I should be able to just dump a lot of my game ideas and content into a spreadsheet, and then it should automatically generate a deck that then people can play and sync. And so I started building it, noodling on it. And again, every step of the way was like, how do I make this approachable to somebody who doesn't know how to code? And I figured almost everyone can, you know, open a Google Sheet and just do some creative writing, drop some ideas down. And then if you copy that link into the storysynth.org website, it'll completely generate the game for you. And there's a variety of formats. So the first format was the very simple For the Queen format. Actually, that's not quite true. So quick tangent. The initial game I designed for it, although the idea was very much to take it in the For the Queen direction, was a game I submitted to Golden Cobra, which is a really great American freeform LARP competition that runs every year. Very worth checking out. Tons of great short free games. Really great inspiration of like different game ideas. Go check it out, goldencobra.org. So I designed a game for that called Dawn of the Monster Invasion. And the idea is that you're doing a spoof. So you're seeing the mockumentary spoof theme pop up again. You're doing a spoof of monster movies through six interviews. And so first you rotate around who's the person, who's the interviewee, and then really they're giving a speech, and then you can do some Q&A after the speech. And so whether it's the person who they think they saw something, but they're not really sure, and everyone's doubting them at the beginning of the monster movie, or it's the like way overconfident mayor who's saying, it's totally safe, come enjoy your vacation, there's definitely no monster, it's totally fine. You know, it's all those very tropey beats. And so I knew I wanted, this is a fun game I wanted to make. One of the key inspirations here is a game by Chad Wolf and Jeff Dieter, No Further Questions, which is very adjacent to this. It's like basically a bunch of one-off press conferences about topics that nobody should be having a press conference about. It's delightful. It's not yet out publicly, but hopefully they're kickstarting it soon. So follow them to see that. But I was inspired by that. I was inspired by like, how do we make a silly monster movie game? But I also wanted people to be able to really easily play it remote. And so the initial story synth thing I designed was that submitted to Golden Cobra, was lucky enough to win the Golden Cobra Best New Tool category for both Story Synth and the game. And so that was really cool. But like, as I was building it, it was very much like, cool, every design step along the way, how do I make it so that other folks can make things as easily? And so that's where shortly after finishing the Golden Cobra game, I said, okay, cool, let's open source this thing. Let's put it online so anyone can use it. Let's write out a guide and have some templates so people can just go, cool, we're going to create a new spreadsheet, you know, copy my template spreadsheet, change all the prompts, and paste the link back into StorySynth, and boom, you have a game. And since then, it's just been a series of elaborations of like new formats, new custom features and options. So like a quick tour of some of what's out there. The core, I think the flagship format is just shuffled, which is the For the Queen. You have one deck, you have a series of ordered cards, which are your initial instructions, and then the rest are just prompts to be reshuffled that you randomly draw that are asking you about, maybe it's about your character, or maybe it's about the setting. It's really up to you as a designer what those prompts are. And from there, it was really easy to add on another format or twist on that format, which is multiple decks. So in Every Alder is the Quiet Year, you have a deck for spring, then a deck for summer, then a deck for fall, and a deck for winter. You know, if you want a story that has a bit of an arc to it, so, you know, it could be season-based or it could be a classic three-act structure. You can have a different deck of prompts for each act. So I made it so that you can do that. And then started playing around with some other formats. So I added one that's phases. So phases, similar deck approach, but you're always rotating through and drawing from deck one, then deck two, then deck three, then back to deck one, two, three. And so my game Around the Realm, which is the quick pitch for Around the Realm, it's Jules Verne Around the World in 80 Days, but in like a magical fantasy world. And so you're telling the story of two companions as they race all the way around the realm to try and get back home before the summer solstice because they've made a wager and they really don't want to lose it. And so in this case, I'm using the phases format, and you are basically alternating through like a quirky mode of transportation. So we're going via a nexus of portals or via a flying ship. And then the next prompt is going to be an escapade. Is it that there's a mutiny on board this means of transit? And then the next prompt just tells you, okay, resolve that. So it's like, get into trouble, get out of trouble, get into trouble, get out of trouble, as you sort of rotate around who's narrating. And so it's mode of transport, trouble, get out of trouble. And then it's you arrive at a new city, which might be a city of animated skeletons controlled by necromancer bureaucrats. And so you have to describe the characters entering the city and some of the sights and sounds of the city. And then you draw the next card, which is, okay, it's an escapade in the city. So you are, maybe there's a case of mistaken identity and they think that you are the great, you know, necromancer scholar. I don't know, whatever you want to make up. And suddenly, you know, you've been sort of like brought in and they want you to be like teaching the like a lecture hall full of budding necromancer bureaucrats. And then you have to describe, okay, how do you resolve it? And so like this phase these is like you're just going going through and narrating, okay, getting into trouble, getting out of trouble, and then whenever you want, you can return sort of back home by hitting a button that takes you to the ending sequence. So a lot, I guess that was a long tangent into one specific game, but the it sort of highlights my design. Like in this case, I was really excited to tell a game that involved phases. I think I had the idea for Around the Realm, but I didn't have an ability to do that in StorySynth. So that inspired me to be like, okay, cool, let me just code it up, and now there's another way to build games in StorySynth. And I think I love this project because there's just endless cool directions to push it in. And whether it's being driven by, this seems like an interesting format, let me build it and then make a game for it, or I really want to make this game, but I don't have the technology to do so, so let me build the technology. Like, both those are just, like, such a treat to explore. Not to mention all sorts of other extensions and formats, so if you want to keep track of characters or player turn order, there are all these extra little widgets that you can bake in if you want. But but again, like, the what it's simplified down to from a design process is, for the most part, I could just start with, like, a creative writing exercise. So in Around the Realm, I think that the game design side of that started with, let me come up with a list of 20 cool fantasy settings that are like isolated cities that or regions that people might visit. And then let me separately come up with a bunch of complications. And then let me separately a bunch of modes of transit that are like whimsical or quirky. And it basically distills a lot of the game design down to just creative writing. And that's just, it's a really fun treat. And then the ability to like spend, so I've talked to friends who've built games with stories since. I was talking about Raf D'Amico, who I mentioned earlier working on Zone. He designed a game inspired by the very creepy show Raised by Wolves about children being raised by a robot on an alien planet. And so he sat down in the morning, spent maybe a half hour to an hour coming up with the game and the prompts, and then we played it. So like the entire process of like going from like idea to playtest was maybe an hour for him, which is like the coolest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's amazing because a lot of people feel like that's me. I'm one of those people. Feel like they have to spend so long trying to polish something that is going to be destroyed by play storming anyways. So I love that you've sort of facilitated a new, I don't know if I want to say new, but a unique and innovative way to do the design process and also create design constraints, because some of the, you know, like you said, there's this parallel design formatting that's happening here in that I want to put a cool game in here, but I don't have the tech. So now I work on tech. Cool, I have the tech for this game, or I want to put a game now that this tech is in existence. Let me design a game using those principles. And they keep resonating with each other and forcing you to sort of expand until, if that creativity stops producing juice for you and you leave StorySynth behind and it just exists, that's fine too. But I love that it is sort of another, it's almost like you create another framework game in a way that allows people to test the bounds of their creativity. Just another creative outlet, I guess, is what I'm ultimately trying to point to.
Yeah, totally. And I think a lot of the momentum and the inspiration behind this is like, I firmly believe that everyone can be a game designer. And by lowering the friction to designing games, lowering that barrier, there it just increases the odds that somebody's going to be able to take that first step and make something and have that joy of seeing something they made being played by people and people having fun and creating novel stories. And that's like, oh, it's the best. So if I can empower more people to do that, amazing.
Where do you think the current nearest future of StorySynth is? Like, what do you think you want to add to its already existing state?
So I think it's at a pretty good stable point for like a V1. Some directions that I might go in. So there's more formats I want to add. So right now there isn't a format where you get to choose what deck you're drawing from. So I think that's like probably an interesting one. There isn't a way of like holding hands privately, cards privately in your hand. You're just always playing one card at a time publicly. So I think some secret information might be an interesting direction. And other directions, like at some point I want to do a huge UX UI overhaul to make it. So the way I wrote it, it is instantly playable on mobile or on a browser, but it's the mobile version, while perfectly usable, it doesn't feel like it was designed mobile native. So there's some like visual bits I want to do there. The big leap forward, which is going to be, you know, a lot more work. A lot of the features and projects is like, oh yeah, this is an afternoon or this is a long weekend. The big thing I want to do at some point is to have really deep integration between the cards and game state. So right now through custom options, through adding a row to the top of your spreadsheet, you can say, hey, I want some basic game state. So track the number of players. So okay, here's an example, like the number of crew members on a pirate ship, the amount of resources, the amount of gold that you or treasure that you've amassed, and the amount of ammo you have left. Like, you can do that easy state tracking, but none of that is connected to the cards themselves. So a bit of a re-architecting so that some cards will automatically start adjusting stats. Like that is a super cool direction that I think opens up an even broader design space. And at some point, I'll take a week or two and maybe just try and hammer that one out. That's a bigger one to chew on. And something I realized I'll call out because I didn't mention it earlier is one of the design principles behind StorySynth is that you don't need to know anything about code. You can just throw in prompts and get going. But if you do know a little bit of code, specifically if you know a little bit of CSS, which is how you visually style things online, you can really get custom with how the game looks and feels. So changing around the fonts, the background color, the text color, the spacing, like embedding images. There's actually a ton of flexibility because ultimately that cell, that prompt in the Google Sheet gets reinterpreted by StorySynth as HTML. So if you just put it as text, it'll be interpreted as text, but you can throw in all the HTML tags you want, all the CSS you want, and it'll just work. So lots of flexibility there to take it from like very, very simple first idea through to something that looks polished and distinct, and if you weren't told, maybe you wouldn't know it was a StorySynth game.
That's amazing. And so we kind of have a clip of the far future, and I love that while the option is there, and it may have some friction for people who are like, ooh, I don't want to, you know, it's still usable, but I'm saying there's probably a person who's like, oh, I don't really want to like super customize this. It doesn't fit my current needs and I don't want to learn CSS. What I counter to that thought is that you're also allowing people to start learning about skills that they may not be utilizing, especially in a modern landscape, right? Like when we talk about HTML and CSS, at some point, the new storefront is going to be a website. Like, that's just, I mean, it is. I know people feel like I'm saying this, people are like, well, duh, Jeremy, that's already true. But, like, it's going to be so much more the standard as time keeps moving forward. You know, there's all these innovations with, I watched some videos with Gary Vaynerchuk, and Gary's always harping on about the future of the virtual assistant, the Siris, the Google Homes, the Alexas, and how Alexa needs a website to order you food or product from with that voice command. So there are businesses and markets that are going to look to expand. Even mom and pop stuff is going to look to expand into the digital plane because that's going to be the version of least friction for those people. So I love that you're sort of saying like, hey, you know, if you want to do some digital design, learn these relatively simple tools. Obviously, it's not easy for everyone, but I love the poke at it. I love that you're presenting that permission that you can learn this too, sort of thing.
Yeah, and just like I firmly believe that everyone can design games, I believe that everyone can learn to code, and that, sort of as you were saying, it's a super empowering thing. Like, I'm not a classic, formally trained or classically trained web developer. I taught myself. And so I was able to build something like StorySynth without a lot of formal training or formal help, and a lot of it's just about little bite-sized projects and steps along the way. So to the extent that you're already starting to work on this, but you're intimidated by building a full website, it's easy to say, cool, let me take a StorySynth game and just start by tweaking some of the CSS. And I don't need to worry about all the code everywhere else. I, you know, just a little bit of CSS here, and I can immediately see the impact because there's like a super quick feedback loop. I will say StorySynth itself is completely open source. So if you have an idea for like a super funky format, well, first off, tell me because I might be excited about it and want to make it or work with you to make it. But more to the point, if you want some like really bespoke customization or you want to build a game on StorySynth but then have it hosted on your own URL. Actually, I know of a team in Australia right now that's done that, and they're actually using StorySynth for serious games with a client, and they want it on their own like consulting domain. It's open source. They just were able to download StorySynth to their desktop, do a little bit of customization, rip out what they don't need, keep what they do, and voila. So, I mean, a lot of my ethos, and I think this echoes through my game design too, is that like everything's a remix, and the more that's out there for people to play with, the more accessible things are, the more amazing things that we'll all see, the better off we will all be. So like a lot of my games are released under Creative Commons licenses, and StorySynth is under an open source license, so people can do whatever they want with the code. And like, I don't know, some of that might just be me. You mentioned solarpunk. Like, I love the solarpunk vision, and I feel like I'm very much a like post-scarcity guy who's living in a world that isn't post-scarce yet, but like, let's drive toward it. Let's get there.
Yeah, I'm super about it. I spoke with, like I mentioned before, Tracy Barnett, and they recently made a business model for themselves where if you subscribe to their Patreon, you get all of their games. Full stop. Everything that they'll put out, but what they've sort of transitioned into is saying, hey, when I reach 75 patrons, I will re-update this game. So creating like this altruistic atmosphere of like, hey, when everyone is paying for this and I feel like I've gotten the monthly income that I need to make this worth it, everyone gets to benefit, right? And what that really And it's all different tiers. It's like 1, 5, 10, 15, 25, 50, and you can pay whatever you feel is appropriate for the value that you're getting here. But what's important about this is that it creates a version of accessibility that I think a lot of people are scared to do. I certainly am. I won't deny that. Like, I won't deny that I don't want to – there's a part of me that's scared to put out, like, any games I create for a dollar or free in some facet. But – what Tracy points to is that not everyone's going to be willing to use Patreon for whatever reason, and not everyone lives in that Patreon atmosphere. So there will still be customers who will go to Itch or go to the website or go to DriveThru or go to DMs Guild or wherever their products are living, and that will be their source. So they're still paying $25 for this PDF or $15 for this one or blah, 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 blah. So the incomes are varying, but it creates different value options for people and allows them to customize their interaction with Tracy's brand and their games. So when you talk about commercial licensing and open sourcing and creating an environment where everything's a little bit more accessible for a wide spectrum of people and that they get to take control of their creative consumption, then I agree. I feel like we would be in a way stronger place. We would see a lot of new, because we talk about remixing, right? There's a lot of people who say that original ideas don't exist anymore. And I don't know if that's 100% true, because in this, speaking to the vacuum that is American culture, we ignore a lot of marginalized voices, right? So we don't get to see them in the mainstream. We don't get to see their experiences or their perspectives in mainstream medias, games, films, TV, music, whatever have you. And so technically those are original ideas that have not been developed in. And if we create spaces that allow people or give people permissions to be like, hey, you're welcome here too. Play with what you want. Do with it what you will, and let's create something better, and let's be kind to each other. You know, I'm not here for the plagiarism conversation, right? The pirating, but, you know, I think there's something to be said by making your stuff open, making it accessible to all the different people who may not be making enough to splurge. They would consider it money is relative. So $8 to them is food for the next day. You know what I mean? So, and there are other people who are like, $50 is no problem. I'll spend $300 on Invisible Sun. No worries. You know? And I love it. I just wanted to say that that's all to say. I love it.
Yeah, I'm 100% with you on everything you just said. And I think there's lots of meaningful discussions about how we price our work, and because we don't want to depreciate the whole value of the category by making things cheap, but we want to make it as accessible and inclusive as possible, especially to folks who are marginalized, don't have a lot of money to spend on things like this. Part of the way I've threaded the needle there is for the few things I have on Itch that are paid, having a price that seems like a nice high fair price. It's not like depreciating the category, but then having unlimited community copies virtually, like, you know, 1,000 community copies that I'll keep refreshing periodically, that make it so that nobody, even if they have the slightest reservation of like, oh, I don't know if a community copy's for me, like, there's no scarcity there. There's so many community copies. Just take it, enjoy it. I think it goes back to a theme that we've talked about a few times this call of like, how do we make it as easy as possible for people to start designing? And I know games that have been open sourced or have SRDs tend to be great on-ramps. So I know like Lasers and Feelings is most likely a lot of people's, it's like a very easy first thing to hack. So you choose two stats and then you have a game. Mm-hmm. Or For the Queen, likewise, it's just creative writing. You're coming up with a bunch of prompts. So I think the more we can encourage people to create these free on-ramps where people just know they can create the thing and then they have a game that they can share and they're not worried about piracy if they're sharing because, you know, they have the creator's permission. I think that's great.
It's the future. I want that future. Damn it.
Post-scarcity now.
Woo! Woo! With that, then, thank you for diving into Story Synth with us. Please use it. Please explore it. Please design games for it. I think it's, you know, I'm a big proponent of modern and electronic and the future when it comes to game design and really considering the digital landscape. And, you know, it's not like there's not a place for pen and pencil, but or pen and paper, but the future is coming. It's not going to be stopped. Randy, I want to thank you for being here today on Draw Your Dice. One last quick plug, reiteration, where can they find you? Where can they get this stuff? All of Randy's information will be down in the show notes, along with some of the articles that we've been talking about throughout the show will be down there as well for listeners.
So you can follow me on Twitter at Randy Lubin, or on my website, randylubin.com, for all of the broader things I'm doing. My consumer games live at diegeticgames.com. My serious games live at leveragedplay.com, and StorySynth is storysynth.org. There are, I think, 7 or 8 games already up there that I've made and other people have made too. If you make a game, I would love to hear about it. I'd love to add it to the gallery. If you want more features to be added, please reach out there too. I'm always like looking, part of what gives me motivation is like, oh, somebody wants to make something and they want a feature for it. Cool, let me go code that up. So please don't be a stranger. Reach out, share what you're working on. And then yeah, Jeremy, thank you so much for having me on the program. This is a super fun conversation for me to have. I've really enjoyed your questions and your extra thoughts and like the different mental models that you've had that you've shared too. So this has been a huge treat for me.
Woo! It's just two geniuses in a room just chatting. You know what I mean? Just chat. I have 0 games. I'm not a genius by it, but Randy is. Follow Randy. Follow Randy's blog. Listen to Randy. Randy's got good stuff. With that, thank you everyone for coming in today. Thank you for listening with us. I learned a lot from Randy. I hope you certainly did too. And we will catch you next time. Say bye to the people, Randy.
Bye, people.
Bye, people. All right. That's a wrap. Thank you for taking the time to sit down and hang out with Randy and I. We really appreciate it. You can find links and resources down below in the show notes, such as getting in touch with Randy or other episodes with similar topics. If you want to be a part of the conversation, please come and join the community Discord server. Also, make sure to subscribe to the Draw Your Dice Patreon, where you can get access to early releases of episodes from as soon as we interview. Thanks again for stopping by, and as always, I will catch you next time.